Right?
Cool. Okay.
Yeah. It is.
Cool. All right. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. We are gathered today on March the 23rd, 2017, for the purpose of a public hearing on Senate Bill 5540, the Department of Transportation. And we would call up to the front Director Garrett and anybody else from Team ODOT. I see Mr. Gard and I see Mr. Mather.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Matthew Garrett. I have the privilege of being the director of the Oregon Department today. You are correct, Madam Chair, that we will lead off today with Mr. Gard giving his presentation on the rail and then the transit portfolio. And we have Mr. Mather on deck to engage the highway portfolio. So with that, Madam Chair, unless there are any questions of me, I turn it over to Mr. Gard to begin the rail conversation.
Sign in, please.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, my name is Hal Gard. I am the administrator of the Rail and Public Transit Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Senator Johnson, I know that you had specific questions that you wanted to have answered around passenger rail. If you don't mind, I would like to do those when I get to the passenger rail section.
Sure.
And I'd like to cover each. I have five major programs in my portfolio. I'd like to do them in order so that I can tie my performance measures directly to each program. We used to be two divisions up until 2012. We have blended those. We've achieved some excellent efficiencies and some good cross-pollination, but we still have two separate limitations. So I'm going to give a rail presentation, do a brief pause, and then hop over to the transit side of the house because of the separate limitations.
Sounds fine.
The five programs are crossing safety, rail crossing safety, rail safety, which is the heavy rail component of the portfolio. We have state safety oversight, which is the fixed rail guideway component. That includes light rail, streetcar, and trolley systems. We have rail operations and planning, and that is the part that also includes passenger rail. And then we have the public transit section. So I'll start with crossing safety. It's a unit that manages all the highway and rail crossing improvement projects, and it enforces state and federal laws and rules relating to highway and railroad crossing safety. And the goal is really to minimize those negative impacts of those two conflict points between rail and highway. We work with public and private entities, including the railroad companies, public road authorities, and law enforcement to address crossing safety concerns. Road authorities and railroads apply to the crossing safety unit for permission to construct, alter, or close public crossings, and such actions are then authorized through a crossing order. Any disagreements around the crossing order process are adjudicated by an administrative law judge. So it's a little different than a permit process. It's actually an order which directs parties to take particular actions.
Mr. Gard, how much teeth does rail really have around that? And the reason that I ask is that I had struggled to try to keep a crossing open for some period of time and got zero help from UP. In fact, quite the opposite of help. If you and the railroad disagree, does it automatically go to an ALJ, or are you at disadvantage given the broad authority vested in the rail by the federal government?
We work very, very hard, Chair Johnson, to try to work through all the issues. Now, of course, a crossing has absolutely no benefit to a railroad. And, you know, they are dangerous areas. And we are directed in statute to try to limit the number of crossings, certainly limit the number of new ones that are developed, and we do want them to be as safe as possible. So we do work very, very hard. In my tenure, so it's been 5 years, we've only had one case that almost went to an administrative law judge, but we were finally able to work it out satisfactorily between the parties. So we're not stiff-armed by the railroads, but we do work very hard to try to get all the parties together and agree.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. We inspect annually 2,400 public crossings where we have complete authority. There's an additional 2,400 private crossings in the state where we have a little limited authority. Those are private agreements between the property owner and the railroad, but we do ensure that they're properly signed, and that is another one of our key components. Crossing Safe program is funded 50%, and this is to staff only, from the rail fund. That's the gross revenue fee that we collect from railroads on an annual basis. And then 50% from the grade crossing protection account. And that's Section 130 money that comes to us from FHWA. That's a very small bucket of money that we can use for improvements on rail crossings on our system or on other systems. It's traditionally been $2.8 million a year. We got a one-time infusion of $4.5 million for 2016. It's a one-time infusion, and it'll decrease back down to $3 million in 2017 moving forward.
Mr. Gard, given the number of crossings that you have, and this spills a little bit into some of your other programs, do you have enough horsepower to do these, with a public emphasis right now on rail safety? And I know for the short line in my district, when they're hauling something that is even remotely problematic or hazardous, they do pre-runs of the tracks, and they either walk them or they high rail them. Do you have enough horsepower in your shop to adequately do this work?
If by horsepower you mean money?
I mean people, I mean money.
I think we're well staffed. I think we're meeting our needs and our obligations. We issue between 25 and 130 crossing orders a year. The workload seems to be sufficient. And these folks aren't the ones directly dealing with the inspection of the rail lines themselves, other than the crossing and the crossing appliances. So I think we're well staffed in that regard.
You heard it here first, people. An agency or a subset of an agency that said they have enough money. Make a note. You won't hear that again.
Well, what I am worried about is the amount of money that we actually apply to crossing safety. $3 million a year does not allow us to do any grade-separated crossings, which are, of course, the safest crossing, and those generally run in the $10 million range. It takes us many, many years to save up enough money for a grade crossing separation. I think it took us like 8 years to come up with the money for the crossing separation on Wiki Up Junction, which is four-lane Highway 97. That is crossed by the Burlington, by the BNSF mainline track. We're just completing that now.
And do the railroads give you any help? Because it seems to me that BNSF would have a real interest in making sure that that Wiki Up crossing was as safe as practicable or as humanly possible.
Yes, they do, but they expect participation from the Road Authority. That's a very large facility. I believe it came in at $14 million.
And what percentage of that did they pay?
I don't know offhand, but I can get back to you.
I would just mark this, colleagues. In Connect Oregon, the Class 1s have done very, 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 very well.
Okay.
Class 1s being?
The big guys, UP, BNSF.
Okay.
Very. With regard to performance measures, from 2007 to 2015, we had a number of highway rail at grade crossing incidents. They decreased by 21% from a high of 36 to a low of 15. Of the 15 crossing incidents in 2015, 11 involved motor vehicles, 4 involved pedestrians, 6 were fatalities, and 2 were injuries.
And this includes light rail?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. We regulate those crossings as well.
This is a kind of grisly question to ask you. How many of those are genuine accident, and how many of them could be characterized as suicide by train?
We suspect that a high number are suicide by train. It's very hard to prove after the fact, but we suspect quite a few are.
Okay. How has the Salem separation worked? Other than I think there are a couple that may be suspicious in terms of someone doing themselves in.
Yeah, we haven't had many instances. We did have a pedestrian fatality outside of the quiet zone improvements. I do notice, though, regularly that folks don't honor the crossbar, which requires the train to sound off, so they're not getting the sound suppression they'd like to because folks aren't using it the way it's supposed to. But we haven't had many instances within the city.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I'm moving on to rail safety. Rail safety really consists of two discrete programs. There's the heavy rail program, which we administer consistent with Federal Rail Administration regulations. And we have our state safety oversight program, which focuses on the rail fixed guideways. And that's light rail, as I mentioned, streetcar and trolleys. And those are administered by FTA regulations. And Representative Meek, thank you for carrying my adjustment bill. I appreciate that very much. We utilize a combination of inspections, audits, enforcement actions, and industry education to improve railroad safety and reduce the incidences of derailments, accidents, and any potential release of hazardous material on the Oregon's rail networks. We conduct inspections to enforce federal and state regulations. We have several related to track conditions and the equipment itself. I'm going to start with the heavy rail component. We act as agents for the Federal Rail Administration. We provide federally certified state inspectors that complement the federal railroad inspectors. And give you an idea, I have 11 certified inspectors on my staff. The FRA Region 8 has 48 inspectors that cover 8 states. So the inclusion of my staff, basically we add 2 times the number of inspectors to cover the safety of the rail within the state of Oregon. They inspect all Oregon railroads, and they have the authority to issue violations, to call out and record defects found on the rail lines. They levy fines, and they work with the FRA to develop compliance agreements and emergency orders.
Has the cause of the Mosier accident been dispositively adjudicated?
Yes, Chair Johnson. The cause of the derailment was what's called wide gauge. It was alarming because the fastening system was relatively unique along that section. Instead of traditional railroad spikes that were pushed through plates into the ties, they were using long lag bolts that tied the plates, and it allowed the plates to stay in place when they replaced the rail. Those lag bolts had been broken a long time, but the shank of the lag bolt extended into the ties and provided enough support that it was not detectable by our inspection methods. In fact, they ran what's called a gauge restraint truck down that track not too long prior to the accident, which exerts many thousands of pounds of force out laterally against the track, and it was not detected at all. Something happened, either a train that went through before that oil train came through, or something with that oil train forced out one of those plates, and because those bolts were already broken and had been for a long time, it opened up that track like a zipper. To UP's credit, they voluntarily replaced that fastening system up and down the gorge, completing it last summer, and they are in the process of removing that fastening system everywhere in the state of Oregon.
Had there been any suggestion that there had been sabotage involved?
No, that has not come up at all.
Thank you. Continue.
Yeah. In 1974, Oregon was the second state to voluntarily join FRA's State Rail Safety Program. It's what gives us the ability to augment the FRA inspectors. And since that time, 31 additional states have joined the program to add their own FRA-certified inspectors. Generally, a larger rail safety inspection force results in the correction of more safety defects, and it gives us a better response to public concerns, and we do see a reduction in rail incidents. In late 2014, we hired an additional 4 inspectors to address safety concerns posed by the nearly 5-fold increase in crude oil trains that were coming in the state in 2012 and 2014. I would just quickly note that it appears that the crude oil by rail peaked in 2014. That was at a high of just over 24,000 carloads. What we saw in 2016 was just a little over 10,000 carloads, although it is still traveling through the state.
Senator Hansel.
Hal, before we get too far off, I had kind of a follow-up on what Senator Johnson was asking. When will their replacement be completed for that type of attachment mechanism that was found to be at fault in Mosier?
Chair Johnson, Senator Hansel, I don't have an exact date. I know that they completed the work in the gorge and that they were starting that work across the state. They tend to use those plates where there are curves and I will follow up with the railroad and find out what their completion date is.
I think it would be important for the public to know that this was a problem and they're going to be removed, because nice to have the gorge, but a lot of people travel up and down
absolutely.
North south on the inner.
Absolutely, and that was a strong commitment by the railroad, and it's part of their compliance order. So I will follow up and get a completion date. In terms of performance measures, we had a slight uptick in derailments in 2013 and 2014, but overall derailments in Oregon have steadily declined. From 2007 to 2016, the number of derailments caused by human error, track, or equipment decreased 61%, from 36 to 14. We believe it's due, in part, to our increased inspectors, and our work was recently recognized for 2015 by the FRA when they gave our inspection program the top score for all state safety partnerships across the nation. So I'm very proud of that.
Congratulations.
The rail safety program is funded through an assessment on all railroads. It's based upon their annual gross operating revenues. And that fee is capped at 0.0035%. However, we only assess from the railroad the amount of money we need. We're several percentage points below that cap right now, and so we're fully funded and in good shape with that regard. Moving on to the state safety oversight program. The state safety program is responsible for oversight of 82.5 miles of rail fixed guideway, public transportation systems, and that's consistent with FTA regulations, hence the separate program.
Mr. Gard, I am going to ask you to say what those acronyms are. I know what they are, but there are people listening. We have new members of Ways and Means who may not.
Chair Johnson, thank you very much for the reminder. That's the Federal Transit Administration as opposed to the Federal Rail Administration.
Thank you.
In March 2016, the Federal Transit Administration published a final rule that significantly strengthened our authority to investigate accidents and oversee rail fixed guideway public transportation systems, and this includes TriMet, Portland Streetcar, the Astoria, and Willamette Shore trolleys. The majority of the state safety oversight funding comes from the FTA under the most recent Surface Transportation Act, 80%. The expenses, and that just covers expenses for TriMet and Portland Streetcar. And the distinction there is that Willamette Shore trolley and Astoria trolley are not recipients of federal funds. We assess a small fee upon them to extend the safety program to them, but we're not allowed to use FTA funds to do that.
And you're a target of opportunity. Have you worked out your issues with Astoria and those bridges?
It's a work in progress.
Okay. Let's see the scoreboard for the good guys versus you. Are we making progress?
I believe so, Senator. Okay.
Well, nobody's been screaming at me lately, and you'll notice I haven't called to scream at you. So,
thank you. Okay, with that, that's state safety oversight. You're going to move on, and this is the fun part. I'm going to move right into. I want to provide a little bit of history. Well, first, rail planning operations. We do more than passenger rail. We do oversee rail planning efforts. We administer our rail advisory committee. We have real estate and a depot that we own that we oversee and manage. But by far, the majority of our work is our passenger rail operation program.
Your depot that you manage, where's that?
The Salem Depot is owned by the
I knew that.
State of Oregon. Yes. I want to give a little bit of history because we do have some new members, and then I'd like to dive into the Senator's questions, which is really going to cover a majority of my presentation around passenger rail. The state of Oregon has been in the passenger rail business since 1994. And when it first started, basically what we did was we wrote a check to Amtrak and paid for our service that way. We started out early on with ridership just for the train. For the first full year of operation, 1995, we had just over 44,000 passengers. That steadily increased over time until just around the turn of the millennium, 2000-2001. We added a second round trip Instead of a single round trip up and down the valley, we added a second round trip, and our ridership essentially doubled. So that first year of two round trip service, we had a little over 95,000 passengers. We enjoyed pretty steady increases in passengers all the way up to 2013, where we peaked at 137,000 passengers on the trains. In 2014, we had a nice little perfect storm where we had problems with on-time performance. We had a proposed schedule change that we thought would lead to an increase in a ridership flop on us. We ended up with a myriad of issues. And ridership, well, gas prices again plummeted, and gas prices are tied nationwide to passenger rail or to rail ridership. So 2014, our ridership fell off to 117,000 riders. Dropped further in 2015 to 104,000 riders, and then we've started to see a turnaround and an increase in riders. For 2016, we had 113,000 riders.
Mr. Gard, when in that time period was a decision made to buy the second train set?
And I will jump into that a little history because I need to provide a little context, if that's okay, Chair
sure.
Johnson. We operate the service in partnership with Washington State. We run the service from Eugene to Vancouver, British Columbia. It's a corridor of 467 miles. As I said, traditionally, we just wrote a check to Amtrak to cover our portion of that, and the majority of the operations were really run out of Seattle. A couple things happened. And we were using train sets. I need to be really clear. This is the Cascade service. It is not the Amtrak long-distance service, which is referred to as the Coast Starlight and the Empire Builder. This is Cascade service. The train sets are owned. The first original five train sets were owned, three by the state of Washington, two by Amtrak. And those trains work in rotation up and down the corridor, coming in and out for maintenance on a regular basis. In 2009, Washington State received nearly $1 billion in American Reinvestment and Recovery Act funds in order for them to increase their passenger rail service. And what we were faced with at the time, in order for them to have enough trains, in order to be able to pick up two additional round trips to cover their service in their state, we were going to lose service in Oregon. So the decision was made to increase the train set fleet, buy two additional trains to bring it up to seven, which are owned by the state of Oregon. We bought those.
Wait,
with
we have how many train sets do we have?
The state of Oregon owns two train sets.
I thought you said seven. That's
there's a seven total in the entire fleet, that we operate them together. They run in rotation. Our trains run in Washington. Their trains run in Oregon. And it just works in a big loop with trains coming in and out for service in order to be able to maintain the complex schedule and dance that happens up and down that
corridor. How much is a train set?
So our two train sets we purchased with ARRA money, again that American that stimulus money that came from the recession, $34 million to buy the two.
The two, so they're $17 million apiece.
And there were additional costs in order to get them certified, tested, and put into service.
Why would we buy an uncertified train set and have to pay extra to get it serviceable?
Chair Johnson, it's new equipment. It's not like going to the car lot and picking something up off the floor. The FRA, when you build them from scratch, essentially, and the FRA needs to make sure that those trains meet all of their requirements, not just on a national basis, but they meet the safety requirements and operation parameters of the particular corridor that they're going to run on. And that requires, we had to take them to Pueblo, Colorado to do burn-in testing to make sure that they operated according to parameters, that they cornered the way they were supposed to.
You still haven't answered my question. Why on earth would we buy a train set that we then had to do the proving for? I mean, I don't know if you go down to the train store and buy a train, but if somebody is vending trains, one would expect that they would vend them certified for the purpose intended. I bought a bunch of helicopters, and I don't buy the helicopter and then have to go out and get it certificated. It comes ready to fly. Why would we buy a train set not ready to roll?
Chair Johnson, I appreciate the question. That's the process that came about as part of the contract negotiations and FRA requirements.
Did we bungle the negotiations? Why would we have put ourselves in the position of buying something that wasn't flight ready?
Chair John, well,
Mr. Garrett, do you have any insight into this?
Well, Madam Chair, I think Hal's trying to answer it. That's the rules of the game with trains. I mean, I don't think we bungled anything. I think we bought a brand new two train sets. And they just need to be certified to run on the tracks. I just think those are the rules of the game, right, wrong, or indifferent.
Okay, so they cost $17 on the showroom floor. How much did we have to put into them to get them flight ready?
Total cost acquisition is $44 million.
So we added another $10 to the total purchase price, so $5 apiece. So we bought something that wasn't ready to go, and we put another $5 into it.
That's one way to characterize
it. Okay, so I'm just trying to keep a total, and I hope you have a little handy-outy for us that is the total amount spent on the trains.
I'm going to do my very best.
I'm going to want it in writing so I can hold it and see it and remember it and get mad every time I see it.
Chair Johnson, I appreciate that.
Okay.
A couple other things happened that I have to point out. Along with ARRA, which drained a lot of money, a lot of federal money, that didn't require a match on us and allowed
Let
us
me interrupt you one more time. Was the five that we had to add to the not ready to go trains, was that their money or our money? Was that our money or
the
was
additional money came from the state of Oregon to get them certified and tested and on the tracks and pay for Amtrak liability and all of that.
Okay.
Another thing happened along with ARRA raining federal money was what was called the Passenger Rail Investment and Improvement Act. And basically what that did, it was also passed in 2014, it went into effect in 2013. It took away all the federal subsidy for state-supported passenger rail services. So basically the states of Oregon and Washington needed to pick up the entire cost of passenger rail.
That happened before or after we bought the train sets that weren't ready to go that we had to put $5 million in to get them ready to fly?
I would have to check the sequencing between ARRA and PREA, but they were nearly at the same time, Chair Johnson.
I think that's really important because if we, the timing, we went out, bought something, wasn't ready to go, fixed it up, were ready to go, and then had our federal support cut out from under us. I'd be very interested to know what the sequence on that was.
The intent all along really was to try to preserve the service we had and that folks were enjoying in this state. That was the intent.
And Mr. Garrett, did the OTC render this decision or was this internal ODOT or who pulled the lever on let's go buy trains?
Yeah, Madam Chair, the OTC made the decision to use that federal stimulus money to purchase the train sets.
Okay, and were they completely informed of all of the strings that attached?
We certainly did our very best to articulate these were the rules of the game led by the federal regulations, the safety type issues that Mr. Gard spoke to with regard to certification.
I'll
make them aware. Yeah.
I'll quit interrupting you because I want to have time to work out on Mr. Mather. But
thank you. One of your first questions, Chair Johnson, was what have the funding sources for passenger rail been? Is general fund the only source? And currently we use a variety of sources in a variety of ways. And we did some fast homework last night over time. I was only able to get information back to 1999. We will continue to do some serious spelunking to find earlier cost data, but I can only right now report from 1999 forward. From 1999 to 2001, there was a total of $12,583,000 spent, and that was nearly $10 million in general fund, and then we don't know what this is yet. I'm still digging. $2.5 million in state other funds, and what that large purchase was the cost to add a second round trip onto the UP main line, and they required upgrades and various enhancements in order to be able to accommodate the additional slots that we took on their line. And that's a traditional class one request, if you want to run additional service and take up space on their line, then you're going to pay for the improvements in order to be able to run that.
Pay for the rail improvements?
Yes. So if they, there are additional sidings, different additional signaling, if there is computerized track control that's required, they would ask that, that passenger rail funding be invested in their line.
And are you going to have a full breakdown of that?
We are working on that as we speak right now.
So we built UP sidings while they were pulling Connect out of us.
It's the timing of the question when they asked to do that for us to play on the right. I think, Hal, why don't you share with the committee the relationship we have with the Class 1 or the Union Pacific, the obligations they have to allow passenger rail to run up and down that track, but then the obligations we have to use their facility because we are using their facility.
Okay. Thank you, Director Garrett. Chair Johnson, so our passenger rail system is a partnership among a lot of different players. So there are two Class 1 railroads. There's the BNSF and there's the Union Pacific. That they own the infrastructure. They do the signaling. They have their own police force. That it is private right-of-way that they own. They have their own business that they service and they run on top of that line. They have a federal, as Director Garrett mentioned, mandate to allow passenger rail, but they don't have to take a loss at it. And so the way there is a fee that is between Amtrak and the Class 1 railroad that is paid to allow the service to run. But when there are increases, there are negotiations. If there's a schedule change, there are serious negotiations, and we're going to touch on that. But that's part of that public-private business relationship that occurs. Amtrak is the operator. They are the ones with the relationships with the Class 1s. They've got the nationwide business. It has been a lot of work to try to change the relationship between Amtrak as the only passenger rail service in the nation to one that is now servicing 26 states and trying to accommodate new business expectations. That's been an ongoing work. And, of course, the state of Washington, which has got their own service and a different set of drivers in the process. So it is an ongoing conversation. It is an ongoing negotiation. It is not always easy. And now we have another party involved with us right now, and that's the Sounder Service, which is commuter rail up in Washington under a separate authority. And we're running our train service over some of their track as well. So we have a lot of players and a lot of people to get to say yes or no.
What I want is a financial display that I don't have to get a shovel to hunt for the pony. I want to know how much. I want to know the cost of the trains. I want to know what it took to bring them up to speed. I want to know all the pots of money that we've been subsidizing this with. I want to know how much we pay Amtrak. I want to know how much we pay the Class 1s. I want to know how long we're hooked in a maintenance contract. I want to know what the get out of the maintenance contract fee looks like. And I want it in a display that is understandable.
And we are working to get that, and I can touch on many of those points you just made if you would like me to.
Let's just wait till you have the display, and we will have you back if necessary. I don't want to chew up all of Mr. Mather's time, but I want this train to stop being such a mystery. And I've been grinding on this now for three biennia, and I still can't get a straight answer, and I'm losing my girlish sense of humor.
I understand very much. A couple things I just want to touch on so that I can move us forward. Last year we did see a ridership increase of 7.9%. We were up to 113,000 from 104 in 2015. We were have taken very aggressive steps to improve our ridership, to market the service, and improve our schedule. Really, the overall ridership thing is all about improving the schedule and a marketing plan and getting to make sure we've addressed on-time performance. So in October 2015, we moved
When there's a failure to perform on time, whose fault is that? I mean, if Amtrak is your operator.
So there are a lot of reasons, and we have a biweekly call with all the parties involved, and it can be just weather events. We have landslides that occur frequently, and that's nobody's fault. That's Mother Nature. It can be freight interference. That's a railroad's fault. That's their responsibility if they're not dispatching in a way that that freight train's not in the way. We had a period of time early on in 2015, you may recall, where we were our own problem, where our passenger trains weren't passing each other in a timely way, and we were causing our own on-time performance. You can have equipment failures, which, depending upon whose equipment, it either lands on the passenger side or the freight side. So there are, we collect that data, and biweekly we sit down with all the partners and saying, what happened? What went wrong? What are we doing to fix it? Now, Amtrak, there's an incentive agreement between Amtrak and the Class 1 railroads to maintain an on-time performance of 80% or better. And I will I'm happy to say trains originating in Oregon going north routinely exceed that 80% on-time performance measure. Trains coming southbound out of Washington, because of the amount of construction and some pernicious landslide issues up there, we have some pretty poor performers coming southbound. But on our side of the line, I think we're doing a pretty good job.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Representative.
Thank you. Just a quick question. Is the state of Washington publicly ran also?
Absolutely. And they're 80% of the service. Chair Johnson, Representative Meek. They are 80% of the service. So they are the big kids in town. Mm-hmm. They have an opposite problem. We are trying to get our ridership up. They have more riders than they have seats. And there's a little tug and pull in terms of how we try to work together and accommodate each other's needs. I'm going to go through this quick since I'm going to provide a written response.
Representative Reardon, please.
Thank you, Chair. Just real quick, so once we're talking about schedules, I'm riding the train from Oregon City to Salem once a week. Love it. Very relaxing. The only issue that I have is the on-time performance. It's constantly like 15, 20 minutes late going north in the afternoon. And I would just like to throw out there that if it's going to be constantly 20, change the schedule, probably some other time, so I know that it's predictable. You know, it's predictable. I don't want to go over there and stand around for 20 minutes, although they're very nice people. So that's just a suggestion.
Chair Johnson, Representative.
I'm going to exercise a prerogative of the chair and wrap you up. I don't know how close you are to the end if we left you alone, but we got highways. It's the biggest part of Mr. Garrett's portfolio, and I want an opportunity to visit with Mr. Mather.
And I'm happy to come back, Chair Johnson. If I can just two things on Pasture Rail, we can quit it and pick it up at Transit. I just wanted to touch on a couple more of your comments. Can we get out of our agreements? Yes, we can. We do not enter into any agreement with Amtrak or our Talgo maintenance contract that does not have a termination clause.
At what cost?
Notice. If we do not have funds, we have to give them a 90-day notice. With the Talgo contract, because we have obligations to FTA around those trains, there is a clause in there that we would do due diligence to have them maintain those trains until they are transferred to another owner. And that's because there is proprietary stuff on those trains. But that's the only clause that exists in those agreements. So we can terminate.
And there's a cost to that, like, sure.
But there is a cost. FTA, if the trains are not in service, we need to sell them to somebody else to put them into service, or we need to give them to another FTA recipient who would put them into service. We recognize that it would take time to resolve those negotiations, so there would be some storage and some ongoing maintenance to keep them in service-ready condition. We have researched storage locations. The best, most secure one is in, I'm going to get this wrong, Grove Park, Illinois, which is a secure Amtrak facility where there are maintenance facilities. There's no room in Seattle, King Street Station. We checked in Oakland. We checked in other places. But we felt it's an asset of the state of Oregon. They need to be secure and maintained. But that would be an ongoing cost.
And if I may, Madam Chair, no, that will be part and more. That'll be part of the soup to nuts financials that you've asked for. We'll go from the birth, and we'll play the scenario out should we not continue to move forward on it. What are the implications of that? Because I want to make sure that you and your colleagues have a full understanding of the implications should we cut the cord, so to speak.
And one of the things that I want with absolute specificity is how much every seat is subsidized right now.
and I can give you that now, or I can give it to you later.
Go ahead, give it to us now.
It's 100 right now, as of 2016. It's $118 a seat, and that is
both ways.
Well, it's 100. It's actually the subsidy's calculated at our total costs for that year by the number of riders of that year. The subsidy will go up or down depending upon the number of riders, because that's the money that they pay for that ticket.
So if I go from Salem to Eugene, it's 118. If I go from Eugene back to Salem, it's another 118?
Yes, that's correct. That is correct.
Okay.
Question.
Senator Hansel.
If I go from Eugene to Seattle, is it 118?
Chair Johnson, Senator Hansen, no, there will be and that's because when you cross the line, you're going into Washington territory, and their financials are different now.
Okay,
and
let's go to Portland. I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. If it goes any ticket between any two points in Oregon, we're subsidized 118.
It's an aggregate. Okay. It has been aggregate. We have got a bunch of different fare buckets, depending upon when you buy, and so it's just you can't parse it out by individual people. We aggregate it.
Got it.
Okay.
On the
average. All right.
Okay, Mr. Garrett, do you want to continue with transit, or do you want me to get Mr. Mather up here and we do half of both, or you want to keep
going?
What
we have, we can run through transit, hopefully at a swifter pace. What we have, Madam Chair, is if we can get Mr. Mather up here for an engagement, we have a little time Monday, because the only other portfolio we have is our central service, our administrative arm, so I think we could use Paul.
That's riveting stuff. So let's continue with transit and light rail.
Okay, moving off passenger rail. I'd really like to... I think everybody has been engaged in the statewide narrative around the need for transit, so I'm not going to revisit that. Just a couple of high points. Oregonians take roughly 130 million rides on public transit every year. My section works to provide transit users with seamless access, mobility, and connectivity as an integral part of a greater state transportation system. We provide funding, grant management oversight, technical assistance to public transportation providers. Our programs support over 150 public transportation providers and transit districts, more than 200 cities and towns, all 36 counties, and 9 federally recognized tribes. We ensure that the transportation providers receiving state or federal funds are implementing projects in accordance with various fiscal and legal requirements that come with those funds. We have a strong oversight component. And we break out our programs really into 3 broad areas. We have general public transportation, funds transit services benefiting the general public in rural areas, as well as bus and bus facilities across the state. So we purchase bus for buses, or help fund bus facilities for small transit districts, folks that are not direct recipients of FTA funds. We fund the special. The intercity transit program, and this is a program that provides intercity connections across the state where there is not a commercial provider, or there is not a public provider providing that service. And the intercity program is distinct from what is traditionally the local provided fixed schedule route. It's point A, point B type service, and it's a premium service. And we do not compete with commercial providers, with the exception of the I-5 corridor, where we use buses to augment our train schedules and fill in gaps.
So tell me how the route through my district works. It takes off in Portland and it shoots through 3 counties or 2 counties?
It takes 26 to Astoria.
Okay.
And it's really a direct premium service, as opposed to the connections that are made by Sunset Empire and CC Rider down Highway 30 into Portland with numerous stops. So it's distinct, it's different. The way I think about it is if you kind of compare public transportation varieties to highway systems, a local district is really your street network providing those regular stops. Some of our more demand response service is more like county roads, where you're taking a group of people from point A to point B within a limited area. So that's your senior bus, demand response, that type of thing. Our inner city service is really more like the highway system where we're connecting communities.
Where'd the money come from?
The money is mostly federal money. So mostly comes from the Federal Transit Administration. There is a small amount of special transportation fund money that we use, give it to service providers for purchase service to provide those connections if they're willing to do that and they're necessary in the area.
Where else is ODOT going to go into the bus business in Oregon?
There are a couple of gaps that we see that we've been trying to work with various service providers. The biggest one right now that we see is between Florence and Yahats. There isn't regularly scheduled intercity service in that area. We're trying to work with LTD. A lot of times districts have got prohibitions on being able to provide service outside their boundaries, and that can be an impediment.
How does this differ from point bus service? Are we talking about the same thing?
We are talking about the same thing, Chair Johnson. That is the point bus service.
Okay, so where do you have point bus routes now?
We have the Northwest Point up in your district. We have Point Cascades, which is the thruway bus service that runs up and down the I-5 corridor, augmenting the trains. We have the High Desert Point, which basically goes from Bend to Ontario. We picked that up when Greyhound pulled out of that service to connect those communities. We've got the Southwest Point, which goes from Kay Falls to Brookings. And connects those small communities down there.
Could you give us some ridership numbers and some costs on those?
Absolutely. Would you like those now or would you like
those? No, later when you come back. And the other question I've got is, if you're running a bus service parallel to the train service, have you done any analysis of how you're cannibalizing the train service?
We consider augmenting. Because we have...
Excuse me, wrong.
Well, and when we add additional or improve our schedules, we actually see bus service go down, not go up. People tend to prefer to ride the train if they can. And actually, we have that kind of correlation. Our bus ridership went down when we changed our schedule, our weekend schedules, and our train ridership went up.
Okay.
We have two key performance measures. One is state of good repair for buses. We own fee title to approximately 1,000 active transit buses that are purchased by ODOT. We keep those titles and we give the bus to the service provider to provide.
When you provide a bus to a service provider and you keep the title, is there a maintenance agreement or an operating agreement? Are they required to change the oil periodically? I keep seeing behind our very expensive transit center in Columbia County a fleet of buses parked back there, and it causes one to wonder, what happened? Are they not running? No routes, no drivers, no maintenance?
Chair Johnson, they are required to maintain their buses and keep them in a state of good repair, and they are required to maintain records of their service and make sure that those buses are as safe as possible. The fleet is aging. Across the board. Our goal is to have fewer than 40% of the buses beyond their use life. It's called state of good repair. So our goal is to have at least 60% of our buses in a state of good repair. Right now, nearly half of the fleet is nearing the end of its use life. We currently spend $6 million in federal funds to keep that fleet in good shape. It's about $5 million short of what we need. Our OTC has approved $5 million over the next, from 2019 to 2021, so $5 million a year for those 3 years to try to raise the bar up on our state of good repair for our buses.
Could you give us a chart of where those 1,000 buses are? Do they go to the big providers like Chariots or TriMet or Lane or just to the little guys?
Primarily they're going to the smaller providers or the smaller cutaways. We have carved out in the past, before my tenure, a chunk of money for major bus replacements. Those big buses are expensive. And there have been special efforts to try to replace those, but the majority of our buses are the smaller cutaways for small rural providers.
Do you do any spot audits on their maintenance records, or do you do spot audits on the type of bus that's being used?
We do spot audits. We have So we've actually got a three-stage oversight piece. We have regional transit coordinators that are embedded in the regions who are working on a regular basis with all the service providers. Part of that is making sure they're doing their appropriate compliance, be it on a vehicle, be it on safety training, whatever that is. They're working with those folks to make sure that they're running their operations according to HOIL.
Those are ODOT employees that are living in certain specified service areas.
Chair Johnson, that's correct.
Do legislators know who those people are?
I would certainly hope so, but I can
tell you I couldn't pick mine out of a lineup.
Jamie Dempsey is your regional transit coordinator, Chair Johnson, and at the next ACT meeting, hopefully I can get him to introduce himself to you. The other piece of compliance oversight we routinely provide is we have a consultant who the goal is to have them out every 5 years, but we're actually getting them to do their audit reviews every 5 years. Those folks are coming in, they're independent consultants, they're experts in their field, they provide a comprehensive review of each one of the service providers across the board. We had that program audited just last year, and it passed with fairly good colors, although they did ask us to step up our oversight of financial management. And then anybody who receives FTA funds, either through us or directly, is subject to an FTA triennial review, which is a comprehensive review of the entire program to make sure we're doing our job right and the recipients of those funds are doing their jobs right. I have one final performance measure, and then I'll land this thing. And basically, that's the number of rides that we provide to our elderly and disabled folks. We have a goal of 2 rides a month available for our elderly and disadvantaged riders. Or 24 rides a year. It still seems abysmally small, but that's our performance measure. We're not making it right now. Part of that's because our senior population's growing, and we've seen a decrease in some key elderly and disabled funding. We're right now hitting 19 rides a year for those folks.
Mr. Gard, how can that work as your key performance measure when those rides are given by providers over whom you have very little control?
They're required to report to us on a regular basis.
Do you track them, though? Because that number is going to be blamed on you. And if you've got districts or service providers that are routinely missing the mark, do you go out and counsel them or send the Jamie Dempseys of the world out to help them out? Or what do you do?
All of the above. We work very closely together with all the service providers. Those folks are dedicated. They're pulling together service with diminishing resources on a regular basis. We do every creative thing we can to make sure that, and we've reproduced best buses for recipients who aren't performing. We've gone out and basically said, this isn't working. We can use these resources somewhere else. We do that work. But the idea is to make sure we've got the resources for the folks that need it the most. There are a lot of folks in this state and rural communities who would like to be able to stay in their communities, age in place. They need to be able to get to critical services, and we try to do everything we can to make sure that happens.
If I may, Madam Chair, I appreciate the offer, because I think we should have conversations about those key performance measures that we may have one finger on it, but we certainly don't have the full hand on the reins. I think that's a legitimate opportunity to say, hey, let us reflect on these, and might we just start to reduce down and actually have key performance measures that we can actually control. I think how was very articulate in terms of the need out there, and what we're trying to do is to ensure that people have travel options available to them. But we don't control those in the entirety, and I think there is a legitimate opportunity for my agency, you and your colleagues, as well as the LFO staff, to have just this type of conversation. I think we can be more disciplined.
Thank you.
So, Representative Rudin.
Thank you. If you could help me understand a little bit, is there a difference between the need that's out there, has that been measured, and the goal that we have? Because sometimes the goal might be defined around, hey, I've only got $1.29 to spend on this, so I'm going to try to do this amount, rather, but the need is perhaps some very different number. Can you help me understand?
Yeah.
Because I'd like to know whether we're really meeting the need or not.
The performance measure was established through studies we did, and quite frankly, it's getting old, and we are actually in the process of revisiting that study that was done by Portland State University, trying to take a view of the demographics of the state, what's the level of need, what would be an appropriate measurement to try to target our services. I would say, from what I've seen in my short tenure in this role, that the need is even greater of a whole variety of services that are targeted across the state. And our investment as a state is 4% of the overall public transportation investment. We spend about $8.53 per person per year on public transportation as a state. The national average is about $53 a year. So I think there's a strong recognition that there's a hunger, there's a need for additional public transportation opportunities. There's a role for the state. We're the only ones with a statewide view. We're looking beyond the district boundaries and trying to make those connections. And I think we need to really refine our measures and think about, are we hitting our marks as a state? And I don't have a handy answer for you right now, but I think the need is huge. It really is.
Follow up?
And I appreciate that. So is there a plan to develop a plan?
We are actively. We have a contract out with Portland State University. We are trying to update our demographics. We are in the middle of developing the public transportation, Oregon Public Transportation Plan. We are halfway through that process. That is going to be the latest, greatest, most up-to-date plan, set of policies and goals for the state around public transportation. My division is working in strong partnership with Jerry Bohart's Transportation Development Division to complete that plan, and so we're about halfway through.
Well,
hope you'll put me on your Christmas list to receive a copy of that.
Absolutely, Representative.
Is the work being done by Portland State bid work or negotiated work?
I will have to check on that, Chair Johnson. I believe that's part of the transportation cooperative agreement that we have in place with the universities for research, but I will get the details and get back to you on that.
Okay.
With that, I will stand down. I look forward to coming back and talking about passenger rail, unless there are other questions.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, one comment for the witness or question. Strikes me that, you know, rail, we talked about how much it costs per ride and so on. Strikes me that what we need is higher frequency, greater certainty, and higher speed. And I think Oregonians have shown that they really like to ride on trains, but those three things are all in demand, and you know, the certainty isn't there. We heard from Representative Reardon, waiting 20 minutes and so on. The speed certainly isn't there. We're not even anywhere close to the kind of speeds that you get in other countries. And the frequency isn't there. And if we could accomplish those things, then I think rail could be a viable transit option in the Willamette Valley.
Chair Johnson, Senator Monroe, I could not agree with you more. I think there are three things that are going to drive all of our public transportation needs in this state in the not-too-distant future. That's going to be increasing congestion on the I-5 corridor. That's going to be our increasing population. People continue to move into Oregon. Third thing is our demographics are changing. We're an aging population. We've got we're going to double the number of people over 65 in the next 20 years. And I think the best example that we have to demonstrate that need is just right across the river, where they're increasing their schedules, they're increasing their frequency. Their fare box recovery is 60%. It's been as high as 66%. Yeah. So if you can get the seats in the trains, you're going to see a return on that investment. What we struggle with right now is that we don't have enough frequency. We are struggling with our schedules, and we're struggling with a dedicated source of funding. So it's a struggle, but I agree with your comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The other thing that I worry about is the right kind of equipment. If I'm going to be using public transport, I don't necessarily need a big diesel bus to haul me in from Scappoose to Portland. If the ridership demands a little jitney of some kind instead of a huge behemoth bus. And I don't know what kind of technical assistance your shop provides for some of the little providers, but that might be something that would be efficacious.
Absolutely, Chair Johnson.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. I look forward to coming back.
Mr. Mather.
You're right. Yeah.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Johnson, members of the committee, Paul Mather. I'm the Highway Division Administrator. I'm going to walk you through the highway portfolio. Talk a little bit about just who we are and what we do. Co-Chair Gomberg, I hope you noticed the photograph I've got here on my first slide. It's part of a comment he made during a ribbon-cutting ceremony we had last fall, was to ensure that we had this sign in place before our budget hearing, and I just put that on the front page just to note that we've accomplished that.
Okay, for those of us that aren't in on the inside joke, help us.
Oh, that's no joke, Madam Chair. Highway 20, U.S. Highway 20, is the longest continuous highway in the United States.
Where does that originate?
And it originates in Newport, Oregon, and goes all the way to the Atlantic coast in Boston, Massachusetts, where the same day that this sign was erected in Newport, the state of Massachusetts put up a sign that said 3,365 miles to Newport, Oregon. And my only frustration there is that because they get up a little earlier in the morning, they put their sign up first.
So, Madam Chair, with that, Paul concludes.
I might also add, Madam Co-Chair, that the Oregon House just declared the Oregon portion of Highway 20 as a Medal of Honor highway, and that bill will be moving your direction. I'd love to see that designation stretch from coast to coast as well.
Good. Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg. It was a delight to be involved in that, and it's gotten a lot of fanfare in the community as well as around the state, just the notoriety of Highway 20 being the longest highway in the country and putting the sign up to designate that. So back to my presentation. Just a little bit about the highways. Highways are the backbone of transportation in Oregon. We talk a lot about wanting diversity in our transportation network, from rail to passenger rail and other things. But it comes down to it from a freight standpoint, 70% of the freight in this state still travels by truck. Truck makes business in Oregon competitive as it reaches out across the country, and having an efficient highway system keeps our businesses in this state competitive. We have over 8,000 highway miles in Oregon. We comprise, while only 11% of the total road miles in the state, we account for 58% of the traffic, and more than 20 billion vehicle miles a year travel on our highways. So just a little bit about a couple of programs that we have, our two major programs that we have in highway. First is maintenance and operations. Maintenance and operations are really just the day-to-day care of our system and the daily operations of our system. Our maintenance program consists of surface repair, and this time of year they are very busy filling potholes and repairing the damage caused by winter storms, but maintaining our drainage systems, roadside vegetation, snow and ice bridge maintenance, and so forth. The other thing they do is they respond to emergencies. Again, referring to our winter storms, but it could be forest fires, a variety of different emergencies that we respond to.
Mr. Mather, have you totaled up the extra costs from what has been a pretty rough winter?
Chair Johnson, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was just going to explain to you that we are just received across my desk yesterday a process that we're going through to do just that, and we are in the process of applying for federal emergency funds to help pay for some of the damages. Those federal ER funds will not only help the state system, but also the cities and counties. We're reaching out to them as we speak to gather that up, which ultimately will likely require another appearance of me in front of you to increase our various limitations. But we're still working through that, but we are actively in the process of gathering that data and hopefully getting some federal relief for the damages we've seen to our system.
Well, all of us that drove across the Coast Range, across the Cascades, down the Gorge, are indebted to the brave men and women of ODOT that, with the exception of a couple of days in the Gorge, kept a system running under some pretty formidable weather odds.
They do outstanding work, and I'm very proud to be part of the organization that they work for. The operation part of our system is just that, and making the operation of our system work better. I have a couple highlights that I'll share later in my presentation that highlight some of the work that we're doing to make our system even more efficient. The other foundational part of our program is our construction program, which is really anchored by our STIP, or our State Transportation Improvement Program. If you're not familiar with that, that's basically our capital construction program that we put together in four-year increments. We are currently in the what we call the 15-18 STIP. But we have the draft 18-21 STIP out for public review, and it's anticipated that our commission will approve that later this summer, and we'll be off and delivering that part of our program. That program is divided into two major areas. One we call our Fix-It, and the other Enhance. Fix-It is just as the name describes, and we're fixing what needs to be fixed out there, whether that's pavements or bridges or culverts, the different aspects of our system. Enhancing is we're enhancing the capacity or enhancing the ability of that piece of the asset to perform. As we've moved through and developed these various steps, we continue to spend more and more from a percentage standpoint of those dollars into our Fix-It side of our program. In the 15-18 STIP, we were roughly about 75% towards Fix-It, and that is approaching 85% as we are in a draft stage of our 18-21 STIP.
Oh, I'm sorry. Co-Chair Gomberg.
No, that's quite all right. Thank you, Mr. Mather, and I echo the co-chair's comments about the great work that your people have been doing to keep our roads safe. I'm one of those people that drives on a daily basis on our state highways, and one of the things I notice over time is the deterioration, not of the roadway, although I notice that, but of our fog lines and lane markers. Mm-hmm. Now, is that what you'd call a Fix-It or an enhancement when the time comes to repaint those lines, which are a significant safety issue?
Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, that is handled by our maintenance forces, so that would be in the maintenance part of our budget. This time of year is when we have the most challenges with our stripes, in that it has suffered through our winter, our sanding, those abrasive materials we use to help drivers deal with the snow and ice, also takes a extreme damage on our striping, the snow plows, so forth. And the weather hasn't improved enough for us to get out there and put down a quality product. But believe me, we're in the ready. As soon as we get breaks in the weather and we have the most severe areas, we will be out there. The other thing that we've done is, if you may have noticed over the years, we've transitioned from purely a paint that we put out there to more durable products that are plastics and other types of materials that last much, much longer. So it's becoming rarer that we've got those situations where we see no stripe or little stripe this time of year, but we still have those situations.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I described our Fix-It process and the Enhance process. Director Garrett covered in his opening remarks, and I've heard several comments already about our Area Commissions on Transportation, or ACTS. They are key to selecting projects in the Enhance part of our program. And for those of you not familiar with ACTS, I would encourage you to be involved, as they are really great advisors for us on the ground locally for the ODOT staff, but also advisories to our Transportation Commission. I know Senator Hansel formerly was on an Area Commission that's familiar with that. I know Senator Johnson is very involved, and I would encourage anybody to help be involved in those. And you really get to see how ODOT works on a monthly or every other month basis. Our staff is in front of them dealing with very localized issues, and they're a form of an accountability for our local staff and a great advisor for our local staff in meeting the priorities of the individual communities. Once we turn to project delivery, I'm on page five. There's a couple key phases that we go through, the preliminary engineering phase. So now we've gone through the selection, we've gone through some scoping, we have an idea of what we want to do and a cost estimate. Now we get to really start rolling up our sleeves and working with individual communities to start tailoring the solution to the specifics of what we're trying to accomplish. And with a paving project or a bridge project, it can be relatively simple. If you're dealing with something like the Newburgh-Dundee bypass or other major projects, that becomes an extended conversation that we have through a permit process, land use process, environmental permits that we've got to go through for our major projects. All those things happen there. As we have downsized our staff on the engineering side the last couple bienniums, we're up to about 50% of this work is performed by consultants. The other half is performed internally. As we turn to the construction phase of our work, that work is done entirely by private contractors. Our role there is just as contractors administrators to administer the contract and ensure its completion.
Yes, we. Well,
as we move forward.
Mr. Mather, are you satisfied with the degree of support that the agency gets from DOJ in terms of contract sufficiency? Is every contract that you engage in with an outside contracting company or consultant a one-off, or are there boilerplates or templates that would give advantage to the state of Oregon? What I'm looking for is your buying power is not insubstantial. And I keep looking for some reassurance that you've got contracts that have sufficient fangs in them, that Oregonians' interests are primary. People are going to do work with you, and if you show up with, here's our contract, take it or leave it. I don't know about the legal sufficiency of some of the contracts that you have.
Senator Johnson, just from a legal standpoint, I'm not sure I could maybe comment on the legal sufficiency. That's probably something for DOJ. But just from an efficiency and working with DOJ, on the construction side, I feel really good about the process that we have engaged with them, and they're very supportive, and we have a long history and developed a great process. On the A&E side, I think we still have work to do. And as you may have noted in the McKinsey review that was done, there's more work for us to do in that area, and we need to sit down with our staff, with DOJ, with DAS and others to continue to work that issue and at minimum make it a more efficient process, but also a more effective process, as I think you're pointing out.
Okay. Please continue.
So a little bit about our major budget drivers. For those of you that have been following our discussions with the Joint Committee, I've been involved in the group with maintenance and preservation, and we had a presentation last Monday night where we went through in pretty good detail just the state of our system. And if you're looking on page 6 of my presentation, you see a couple of graphs there with our bridge conditions and our pavements condition. If you look at the bridge condition graph, you see that it's actually going up in the short term, and that's largely because of the OTIA 3 bridge program that was passed in 2003. Bonded existing revenue, and it really has been a shot in the arm for our bridges. But you can see that while it has had an increase, our forecasts going forward, as the large amount of bridges that we built during the 50s and 60s and 70s near the end or past their useful life, our projections are for those to go down. Turning to the pavements, you see also a decline there. If you look at the new STIP, the draft STIP we have out, we're actually taking money from pavements and putting it into bridges to help kind of manage the downturn in bridges, but it has a consequences on a pavement side of our equation as well. Seismic note you'll see on there, I just referenced the presentation that I made a couple weeks ago to the group and the work that we've been doing around that. On page 7, for those of you who've been around transportation, it's our kind of widely known as our mountain chart graph. It kind of gives you a picture of transportation since the turn of the century, and really since we turned from a pay-as-you-go system to a bonded way of dealing with transportation, starting with the OTIA 1, 2, and 3 programs. We have the ARRA program that Hal referenced, and then the most recent in 2009, the JTA program. And as we near the end of the JTA program, we have about 8 projects still out there under construction, but wrapping up another successful bonded program.
Senator Hansel.
Paul, if we can go back to page 6 for just a second on the graphs. On your bridge, you have a projected target, and you don't have it on what you'd like to see on that I can see on the pavement.
Chair Johnson, Senator Hansel, you're right. There should be one on the pavements. If you look later in my presentation under the key performance measures, it is there and you'll see it. But it's roughly the same looking graph on the bridge as the bridge side where we are today, about where we should be in our target. But we're forecasting out that we will fall below our target.
If you don't get additional revenue.
Right,
to keep
right.
Going.
Partly because we're shifting some of the money from pavements to bridges. But just the overall funding situation and the inflation factors and other things that are impacting our program.
Thanks.
So turning to, I'm going to move on to page 8.
Quick.
I want to hit.
Senator Representative Ridge.
Sorry. Thank you, Chair. I just want to make sure I heard something correctly. Did you say we shifted from pay-as-you-go to put it on the credit card?
Well, Chair Johnson, Representative Reardon, that was a shift with the passage in 2001 of the OT01 program, where up until that point, we hadn't been in a bonded program. We've been in a pay-as-you-go, raise the gas tax, use those funds to pay for projects. But with the OT01, 2, 3 was the first time in a significant way that we moved it into a bonded program and a way to pay for transportation.
Madam Chair, if I may, and Representative Reardon, there's a little bit of a history that informs that. If you go back and you look during the decade of the 1980s, the legislative investment in the transportation system was significant. As a matter of fact, almost every year you see an increase. Mm-hmm. If you look at the decade of 1990s, that really was a decade of disinvestment. And then you get to where Paul indicated in 2001 with the Oregon Transportation Investment Act. That's where we move from the pay-go to bonding some existing revenues, and then revenues that were increased as well to jumpstart those big OTIA investments, and then again in 2009 with the jobs and transportation. But there's an interesting history in terms of how this state has invested, and we see the 1990s as somewhat of a challenging time in terms of transportation and infrastructure investment.
Co-Chair Gomberg.
Thank you, Co-Chair. You know, a few moments ago you made reference to buying power, and as long as we're taking a break from the prepared presentation, I, of course, as you well know, have been asking each agency that's come before us about delinquent debt, and I'll be talking to the gentleman to your right about that a little more as we get to the conclusion of ODOT's presentation. But with the buying power you've got, what steps do we take in the Transportation Division to double-check the people that we're contracting with to make sure that they don't owe money to another state agency in fines and fees and delinquent taxes? I'm just concerned about a scenario where somebody owes us money, but we're hiring them to do a job for us without checking to make sure that that debt hasn't been satisfied.
Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, I'm not aware of a check that we do for what a contractor may owe another state agency. I know from our standpoint there's several steps we go through relative to the Department of Transportation, but not in on the whole of state government.
But if we were in a position to put, a follow-up, if we were able to put some kind of master list together so that that cross-check process was not overly onerous, I hope that you'd be anxious to help us with that overriding problem.
Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, yes, we would be anxious and willing. I think that's an excellent idea.
All right. Thank you so much.
Good. Continue.
So I want to highlight a few of our cost containments or some of our efficiencies that we're doing. And there's a couple of really kind of exciting things happening in transportation. First is just with technology. As technology has really entered all our lives and really kind of accelerated through our lives, the same thing is happening in the construction industry. We are rapidly moving through a three-dimensional electronic version of all our projects, where traditionally you would see surveyors out there surveying points, bringing that data back, transferring those onto drafting boards and creating a set of plans that then would have to be reinterpreted by staff and operators out in the field to build. All that is becoming electronic. We have a mobile mapping system that can actually move down the highway and create a three-dimensional map just by driving down the highway and totally eliminating the need for surveying. That data then is taken, putting into a CAD where a drafter creates a three-dimensional model, creates a design. That information is translated back into a piece of construction equipment that builds that piece of infrastructure without any stake being in the ground to actually build it. It's pretty fascinating technology, kind of fun to watch, but it also has a real difference in our bottom line. As we look at just our cost internally in the department, we've seen up to $2.5 million cost savings just to the department with the investment we've made so far in this technology, and we've just scratched the surface. As we look at projects like the Woodburn Interchange, we've seen construction savings, hard savings, up to 6%, but more importantly to the community and those suffering through a construction work zone, we've been able to take 30 and 40% off the time it takes to construct that project just because we don't have surveyors, other work to be done. Not to mention the safety factors. If you've ever been out in a construction job, and I know in my early days in my career, I've been dodging pieces of equipment or traffic out there to set hubs in a way that's not a safe environment to be in. And so create an environment environment where we don't have workers, contractors, or ODOT workers exposed to those kind of hazards. It's pretty exciting to see that technology.
Mr. Mather, this issue's come up in our transportation conversation about some of the new technologies. You don't have to have wet signatures anymore. I mean, there was some debate about that. Some of the contractors said maybe you did, and I don't know if everywhere accepts electronic signatures now. Do you accept them
everywhere? Yeah, Chair Johnson, I believe we worked through that issue. We're still in a pilot on a few of our projects, but that's the other aspect of what we're doing with electronics is we're taking all our field notes, all our construction documents, and putting all those electronic documents. So we don't have file cabinets. We don't have duplication where an inspector's out there all day long taking notes and then spends all night putting those things into the computer. He does that right there on the job, real time. Just as an example of savings on that front, to process a change order on a contract, the old way would take up to a month to do. Now we can turn it around with electronic signatures. We can turn that around in a matter of a day or two, which time means money to contractors. We can make decisions and keep them going on their schedule.
It might be helpful to share that information with AGC, at Associated General Contractors, at some point, because it was one of their members who told us that there was still a requirement for, this is a new word I just learned, wet signatures.
Wet signature.
I didn't know what a wet signature was.
For those that don't know, what is a wet signature?
It's with a pen.
Yeah.
As opposed to electronic. That's my new word for the session.
Yeah. It's an old signature.
Yeah. It raises another interesting question, and that is with your ability to contact and work with people in the field now.
Yeah.
I know that ODOT is split into regions, and for the benefit of our new folks, there are five regions, that projects are managed within the silo of that region. Have you all ever given any thought to having some really high-performance project manager teams that you could send out on big projects so that they would rove among the regions and that you had proven field superstars who could do a change order, who could get to yes quickly, and instead of relying on the teams inside the regions, that you had sort of super elevated project management teams?
Chair Johnson, we have those conversations. If you look back at our OTIA 3 program, that's how we delivered it. We had a major projects branch that we stood up to deliver that program. There's pluses and minuses to that. You've got, as you describe, a team of experts that really can just hone in on delivering a project. But you have removal from the community and removal from some of the stakeholders out there. And so the value that I see in the relationship that we establish with our field folks out there every day, they develop relationships with our local state police office, with our local other vendors that they deal with. There's a value to that, too. As we look at the funding package that we're talking about, we're going to be looking at all those issues, and very likely we're going to see a different organization to look, just as we did in OTIA 3 and as we did with JTA. You'll see a different approach to whatever package you come up with.
Well, I just want to alert you, at least in these subgroups, that's a conversation that has come up. One other thing, as we're sort of now getting you way off track on your presentation, another question that was visited as late as last night was, we now have the McKinsey report, and it ostensibly says ODOT is an okay agency. There are some process improvements.
Right.
Do you, and I'm asking this of Director Garrett sitting next to you, do you two, that are the two highest ranking guys in ODOT, believe that those issues can be addressed internally by your own people who are on the ground, or do you think that there's a requirement for yet another layer of consultancy to come in and take the Department of Administrative Service recommendations and then go to contract and then dig around in your dresser drawers and then tell you how to run your operation? Do you think you guys can field those DAS recommendations and turn out a work product?
Well, this has not been rehearsed, so we'll see.
No, it hasn't, and you didn't expect this question, and you are deeply on the spot right now.
Fair enough, but let me share. I think there are some areas that we can. I think the real question is, do you trust us to do it? I mean, that's a question that needs to be answered by you and your colleagues. That's one answer there. But there are certainly some of those areas that there is no questions. We have the professionals that can bring the rigor and the scrutiny. I think for nothing more than having an independent set of eyes in other areas, it might be prudent to bring someone back in to say, hey, this is the chart we have, the course we have charted. Are we on the right track? Does it meet with best practices? Again, I'm very proud of the professionals within the department, but I don't want people who may question the department saying, you're not good enough, and I think there's going to be a tension. We're either sinners or saints, depending on who you talk to here. But, Senator, to your point, there are those areas that my professionals can deal with it and deal with it crisply. Then there are those where I think a third-party independent set of eyes is probably appropriate.
Well, I appreciate the candor of your answer, because that's exactly where I think some of us came down last night. Based on a conversation, colleagues, this was the accountability subset of the Transportation Committee, and we were getting the news that the recommendations from the Department of Administrative Services based on the McKinsey report wouldn't even be available until mid-April. We're already, to use a transportation analogy, the train is starting to leave the station. That's for you, Hal, my favorite subject. I'm wondering whether or not we dive back into another set of consultancy arrangements, with the consultants perhaps taking for their fee a percentage of savings. Why wouldn't the transportation professionals that run the agency be able to do that work without another, you know, million-dollar consultant report? And you've answered my question very straightforwardly, and I appreciate it. Colleagues, we're now at 2:30. I know everybody has other obligations. Mr. Mather, because I ran a bad gavel, you got severely shortchanged. So we'll come back, finish with Mr. Gard on Monday, where I think we have a little time, do we not, Mr. Gillibet? And then we'll get you back up to bat. And I apologize for the disrespect of running you out of time. Representative Reardon.
Just a heads up, please, Co-Chair. I would really hope that our presentation on Monday will include something about the orphan highways and whatever's going on, might be going on with them. So
I will commend Mr. Mather. He has brought to me a very comprehensive look at where we could do some of those jurisdictional exchanges. I would submit we're not going to be able to do a lot of them in the transportation package, but if we could do a couple where there was some equality of who got what piece, nobody wants to get stuck on the dog end of that deal. And Mr. Mather did some very thoughtful research and brought it to my office. And if you wouldn't mind having copies for the committee, get them to the professional staff, I think that would be very helpful.
That'd be great.
We'll do
Thank
that.
You. Mr. Gillibet, anything for the good of the order? Colleagues, I apologize for kind of screwing up the schedule today. We're adjourned.
No worries.